Welcome to North Star Church. At North Star, our desire is to lead people to follow Jesus Christ and not simply go to church, but to be the church. The following message is by Jeff Noble, lead pastor and teacher at our Blacksburg, Virginia campus. You can find more information about North Star, including recent podcasts, news, upcoming events, and so much more at northstarfamily.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy today's message.
Well, it's so good to see so many of you here this morning. Next Sunday, I want to call your attention, is pretty excited about it. You may know it's May the 4th, and so it's May the 4th be with you Sunday. And I'm hoping I get to come out to like the Imperial March or something like that next week. But every year, one of our bittersweet Sundays is next year. It's like one of my favorite, but it's also one of my least favorite Sundays. It's Send-Off Sunday. So if you have been a part of North Star, whether as a member, a regular attender, or if North Star has ministered to you in any way, and you'll be leaving sometime this year, graduation, job transition, move, whatever it may be, we want to encourage you to please go to don'tgo.b/sendoff sometime this week and upload just a picture of yourself and a couple of sentences about how God has used your involvement and the ministry of North Star to encourage you in your faith. And then next week, we'll have a slideshow of just all of those who we've had the privilege of ministering to while they've been here in Blacksburg and New River Valley. We'll be praying over you. We'll ask you to come up front. It'll be lined in both services with people that will be leaving. And that's one of the most unique things about living and ministering in a town like Blacksburg, is every year we'll see 50 to 70 people leave our faith community as they prepare to go on to different areas of life and ministry. And so it really is an opportunity for us to send you off well. So let's go ahead now and turn in your Bibles to Job chapter 29. We had such an amazing Easter season here at North Star with Palm Sunday and Good Friday and Easter Sunday. And if you joined us for the first time in the last couple of weeks, we've been in a study of the book of Job for a while now. And we're coming around the corner. We'll be ending it before June gets here. But today we're in Job chapter 29. Here's why where we pick up is just so relevant to what we have just celebrated with Easter. You see, after all, the word that we celebrated last week as being Jesus becoming flesh, sent to earth to give his life for us, rose again from the dead. Jesus himself, in relationship to Job, we look at Job, who was a sufferer, who was a man of many, many sorrows. We learn in Isaiah the prophet, chapter 53, that Jesus himself was a man of sorrow and acquainted with grief. It says he was despised and rejected by men, a man of suffering who knew what sickness was. He was like someone people turned away from. He was despised and we didn't value him. That wasn't the end of the story for Jesus, and we'll learn this morning that suffering wasn't the end of the story for Job either. You see, Jesus, when he was here on earth, he wept. He experienced suffering unlike any other human. He rose from the dead. Gloriously, he's going to come back. He's going to be bringing with him the eternal reward for all of those who have trusted in Christ as their Savior. So let's catch up with our Job series since we've been out of it for a few weeks. We're going to watch a quick 2-minute video just to catch you up with where we've been so far in this glorious book. So turn your attention to the screen.
So Job begins with a strange story that takes place up in the heavens, which are described something like a heavenly command center. So God is there with these angelic creatures called the sons of God, and they're all there reporting for duty.
And God points out this guy Job, his servant, showing how righteous and good he is.
And then one of these angelic creatures approaches. He's referred to in Hebrew as the Satan.
The Satan. Who is this?
Well, this word is actually a title, which literally means the one who is opposed. So out of this whole crew, he is the one questioning how God is running the world. And he proposes that Job might not actually love God, that he's only a good person because God rewards him. If God were to take away all of the good things he gave to Job, then we would see his true colors.
So he thinks Job is just working the system?
That's exactly right. Maybe he's obeying just to get what he wants.
So God agrees to this experiment and allows the Satan to inflict suffering on Job.
And Job loses everyone and everything that he cares about. It is devastating. And remember, he deserves none of this. God himself said so.
The remarkable thing is that in the midst of all this suffering, Job still praises God.
At least for chapters 1 and 2. But then in chapter 3, we find out how he's really feeling inside. He unleashes this poem that reveals his devastation. It's a long, elaborate curse on the day that he was born.
After this, some of Job's friends come to visit him to offer their help. And all of them are like, Job, you must have done something horribly wrong to deserve this. After all, we know God is just, and we know the world is ordered by God's justice and fairness, so you must be getting what you deserve.
And for the next 34 chapters, the friends and Job go back and forth in very dense Hebrew poetry. His friends keep speculating about why God might have sent such suffering, and they even start making up lists of hypothetical sins that Job must have committed. But after each accusation, Job defends his innocence.
And Job is innocent.
He is. He's also on an emotional roller coaster. At some moments, he's very confident that God is still wise and just.
Yeah, in other moments, he's doubting God's goodness.
He even comes to accuse God of being reckless, unfair, and corrupt. So by the end of the dialogue, Job demands that God come and explain himself in person.
And that's where we'll stop, and that's where we are, is that as we pick up in chapter 29, these are what we would call Job's final words of the book. This is what he will last say in his own defense. So let me kind of give you a quick three-point thing of these three chapters we'll look at briefly this morning. In Job 29, the theme of it is Job is going to remember yesterday. In Job chapter 30, he's going to have a significant reality check. And in Job chapter 31, he will make a plea for God to remember his diligence in personal holiness. You see, in this book, as we've been studying it, he has gone from thriving faith, thriving family, thriving fame, because everybody knew who Job was, thriving finances, to only surviving faith. And we've seen throughout that Job was indeed a great man. To see all of his life held in the hands of God, and to see Job respond in great grief with great faith has really revealed Job's great character. And from chapter 3, after Job just unleashed, we see this back and forth, and we've seen three cycles of speeches with these three friends, with each friend accusing Job of sin and Job insisting that he was innocent. We've seen some nuggets of truth throughout these chapters as well. And we've encouraged one another to always discern the truthfulness of what someone is saying. But as much as the friends have been speaking truth, it's been misapplied to Job, because they have presumed and assumed that he has sinned. But all along, we know that Job did not sin, that nothing that was taking place in his life was the result of something that he had done. And another way that we can look at this whole scenario is that in chapters 1 and 2, we have the privilege of seeing behind the scenes, of seeing the conversation between God and Satan, and we realize that what God may be up to beyond what he's teaching Job and us, he may be also taunting Satan. He may be proving to Satan that God is sufficient for Job, and that someone who is in love with the Lord will not recant their faith. Job stood firm in his faith. He's resolute in his belief that God is good, and that belief is going to be sorely challenged, however, in his experience of suffering. So let's look at Job 29, remembering yesterday. I'm not going to read all of these chapters for us because it's just so much material, But if you look at verse 1, and we're going to begin there, but we'll read Job 29, 1 through 3. Verse 1, it says, Job continued his discourse, saying, beginning in verse 2, if only I could be as in months gone by, in the days when God watched over me, when his lamp shone above my head and I walked through darkness by his light. And so Job is repeating these time-worn words that most of us will utter in times of hardship or confusion or frustration. If only. If only. Job remembers the good old days, and perhaps you're there this morning. Perhaps you're in a position in life or situation or circumstances where you're not really thrilled about where you find yourself. Things are a struggle. You may say, I'm not really suffering, but there's some extreme discomfort with my circumstances and what's going on in my life. Maybe you're struggling with grief or anguish or anxiety. Maybe you've got just a deep-seated heart of frustrated bitterness towards someone. Maybe you're angry at God. And you find yourself remembering when things weren't like they are today. You find yourself remembering the good old days. And there are moments in life where we all struggle, and in our present pain and confusion and suffering and heartache, we long for days of yore. We think, I just wish it was like it used to be. What were those days for you? What are the days that you always go back to as your best days that you wish you could go back and reclaim? And maybe you'd understand a little bit of what Job was thinking. Job was just thinking, if only things were like they used to be. And so Job begins to document in chapter 29 how good things used to be for him. So let's look at this remembering yesterday. So first thing that he mentions, and you can see it on the screen behind me, he remembers his perceived intimacy with God. He remembers how close his relationship with God was. In verses 4 and 5, he says, I remember when God's friendship rested on my tent, when the Almighty was still with me. Job's thinking back to, I remember intimate days in my faith relationship with God. And then he remembers the goodness and the rightness of life. And he remembers some things that were good and right about his life. And we see in verse 5, he remembers the presence of his children when he says, my children were around me. And in verse 6, he remembered when everything was going smoothly for him. My feet were bathed in curds. I don't know if that's just great or not, but and the rock poured out streams of oil for me. And then verses 7 through 11, he remembers when he had respect from old people and young people alike. And he documents why he was respected. He ministered to the poor and orphans. He ministered to those in grief and widows. And he rendered just judgments, wise decisions, compassionate help, all from a heart of righteousness. And then Job thought back to his presumed legacy. And he thought, you know, if I had just kept living the way I was going to live, I was going to leave a legacy. And in verse 13 through 17, he says this, I thought I will die in my own nest and multiply my days as the sand. My roots will have access to water and the dew will rest on my branches all night. My whole being will be refreshed within me and my bow will be renewed in my hand. He says, I'm leaving a legacy of faith, and I wish things were like they were. And then lastly, he documents just the reality of he understands who he was. He demonstrates unabashed emotional intelligence, and he defends himself in verses 21 through 25. Now, you'll see this on the screen. Let me just quote a few of these verses, because this is how he's remembering his position. Men, listen to me. They waited for me as the rain and opened their mouths as for spring showers. And here's my personal favorite. If I smiled at them, they couldn't believe it. Job just kind of walked through the crowd and smiled. They go, ooh. And I get a liver quiver because Job paid attention to him. I lived as a king among his troops, like one who comforts those who mourn. So in chapter 29, Job is remembering all the good old days. In the midst of his extreme suffering, he looks back and he says, if only it was like it used to be. Maybe you're there. Maybe sometimes you struggle. And in times of suffering, in times of hardship and circumstances, maybe even not of your own choosing, there are moments when it is good to look back, to remind yourself of God's past faithfulness, and to tell yourself, God has not changed his character. He was faithful in good times. He will be faithful in hard times as well. And that's what chapter 30 turns to. Chapter 30 then turns to this reality check. And we see it in verse 1 of chapter 30. It says, but now they mock me. And so this word, but now, begins an entire chapter of what's taking place now in Job's life. His tour through the good old days are done. Now he squares his boil-burdened shoulders and he looks squarely at reality. And one of the things he mentions right off the top is the worst part is being mocked by people of low character. And verse 1, he says, men younger than I am, whose fathers I would have refused to put with my sheepdogs. In other words, what Job has experienced in his suffering is that people of low character, in some sense, have become like modern-day social media mob. They're canceling him. They're kicking him while he's down. They smell blood in the waters. They've circled him. And even though many of them have formerly benefited from Job's generosity, his character, and his bigness of heart, they are just jumping on the bandwagon now to criticize him. And so we see in the middle of chapter 30, Job turns to prayer. And Job's prayer in chapter 30, verse 20, he cries out to God. He says, I cry out to you for help, but you do not answer me. And when I stand up, you merely look at me. So that's how Job is feeling. He's feeling that his prayers are bouncing off the ceiling back at him and going nowhere, that God is not responding to him. He's confused. And so in his prayer to God, Job is going to plead with God for just treatment throughout chapter 30. And one of the things that we see really clearly in chapter 30 is that Job's theology and his perspective is deficient. Nowhere in here does he acknowledge that he has a spiritual enemy named Satan. He's completely unaware that what he's experiencing is the attack of Satan upon his life, allowed by God to demonstrate that Job is indeed a righteous person. And instead, Job has begun to ascribe to God qualities like capricious, cruel, intolerant of questions, those qualities that would rightly belong to Satan. Because Job has forgotten that he has a spiritual enemy. In chapter 30, verse 25, Job says, have I not wept for those who have fallen on hard times? Has my soul not grieved for the needy? It's this plea for God to remember how he used to treat other people and for God to treat him with the same mercy. Perhaps you too get in situations like Job where in times of intensity or confusion or frustration, you forget that you have a spiritual enemy who is out to discourage you, at the very least to distract you, but is certainly out to destroy the people of God. We would do well as God's people to remember that we have a spiritual enemy and we have a Father in heaven who loves us, who's promised to never leave us, to never forsake us, and to lean upon him in times of hardship. And then we get to Job chapter 31. And in Job chapter 31, Job makes this final plea for God to remember Job's diligence in his personal holiness. And as the chapter begins, Job vulnerably shares all that he's done to practice practical righteousness in his life. We'll mention in just a moment all of the sins that he sought to avoid, both in his inward commitments and in his outward acts of good deeds for others. So chapter 31 is like Job's closing argument in a legal case. He's saying, here's all the things that I have not done. Here's all of the things that I proactively implemented in my life to keep my life from sin. In a sense, he's saying, God, have you not noticed all of these things? But one of the things that we notice is Job's intentional way of living in right relationship with God. We have to ask ourselves this morning, what are we implementing in our own lives to intentionally live in right fellowship with God? What do we do to demonstrate our faith in God? What do we avoid doing to demonstrate our faith in God, whether they are inward commitments or outward acts of good deeds? Look at verse 1 of chapter 31. I'm quoting from the New International Version because it says it really plainly. But Job says, I made a covenant with my eyes not to look lustfully at a young woman. Well, what a great memory verse for a lot of us, to remind ourselves that lust is an inward battle. Job is testifying that he's made that commitment with himself to not look lustfully at women. That's the lengths to which Job has gone to live a life of personal and practical holiness. And then beginning in verse 5, Job is agonizing, but he is assuring his listeners and he's assuring God that he's practiced truthfulness, fairness in his judgments and his dealings with all people. And in addition to saying that he put curbs on his eyes related to lust, Job now testifies that he has avoided this list of sins: dishonesty, adultery, oppression, miserliness, avarice, idolatry, vindictiveness, parsimony, hypocrisy, and exploitation. In other words, what Job is documenting is he's documenting a holy life. He's saying that my relationship with God was not just an attendance relationship with God. I walked with God daily. I implemented attitudes and actions in my life because I loved the Lord so much and I wanted my life to reflect His character to those around me. I like what Francis Anderson said in his commentary. He said this, in Job's views, sins are not just wrong things people do, disobeying known laws of God or society, but to omit to do good to any fellow human being of whatever rank or class would be a grievous offense to God. See, Job demonstrates in chapter 31 that he understood that walking with God is being mindful of sins of commission, things that we do. But also intimately walking with God is being mindful of sins of omission, things that we should be doing. And then in verse 7 of this chapter, we get this glimpse of the depth of Job's commitment to holy living. If you'll glance at verse 7, he says, if my heart has gone astray over a woman, or I've looked, oh, that's verse 9, sorry. If my step has turned from the way, my heart has followed my eyes, or impurity has stained my hands. In other words, he's saying, if my heart has followed after my eyes, that's profound. Job is confessing and he's admitting and he's professing that he's aware that what he sees can distract him and can lead him into not trusting God, and could also lead him into sin. And so in verse 7, we get this glimpse of Job's commitment to holy living, of not allowing what he sees to direct his heart, which is profound because that's the sin of Eden. That's what happened in the garden with Adam and Eve. In Genesis chapter 3, verse 6, listen for the connection between what you see and what you do. It says, the woman saw that the tree was good for food and delightful to look at, and that it was desirable for obtaining wisdom. So she took some of its fruit and ate it, and she also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate it. You see, what we see directs our hearts. What you focus on, your life will follow. And so we must place our faith in God and in His truth. And as people of faith, we have to choose to believe and orient our life around God and His revealed truth. We trust in God's character, even when our circumstances and our suffering may cloud our vision. In 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 18, Paul says it so well. He says, we do not focus on what is seen, but on what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal. And in the very next chapter, Paul would say this to the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 7. We walk by faith, not by sight. And so what Job is professing here in chapter 31 is beautiful. He has trusted God. He's chosen to believe God's ways are best all of his life, even when he sometimes could not see. But now, because his prayers are not being answered and he's suffering, Job is struggling to believe. The rest of chapter 31 is this long series of ifs. If I had done these things, God, then my suffering would be understandable. David Atkins says it like this. Job is here, ironically, challenging God to do what, all unbeknown to Job, God had challenged Satan to do at the beginning, to say what is the fault with Job. Job is crying out to God saying, what is my fault? And in chapters 1 and 2, God has said to Satan, here is Job, fully righteous, completely blameless. He has no faults. Test him and see if any fault comes out. And so Job has this concluding defense, his last statement in this imagined court case in Job 31, verse 35. And he says this, if only I had someone to hear my case. Here's my signature. Let the Almighty answer me. Let my opponent compose his indictment. I would surely carry it on my shoulder and wear it like a crown. And I would give him an account of all my steps, and I would approach him like a prince. In the last verse of this chapter, Job's last song is simply said, the words of Job are concluded. But as you know, there's more to the book of Job, and it's not ended. And so the rest of the Job will look like this over the next 3 weeks. Next week, we'll look at Elihu, this last guy who has a few things to say about Job. But then in 38 through 41, God will finally respond. You will not want to miss that Sunday. And in the last, in Job 42, Job has a conclusion. And we have a glorious way to wrap up the book of Job. So what can we learn from today's passages that we've looked at in these chapters? I think one of the things that we have seen all along is that even a righteous person will suffer. We may never know the reason, but don't ever delude yourself into thinking that walking closely with God will prohibit you from experiencing hardship. The New Testament is clear that we should expect trouble and we should expect persecution. But the glorious thing for those of us who follow Christ is He has promised to never leave us, to never forsake us, that His love is perfect. Second thing that we can observe from today's passage is we too must practice personal, practical righteousness in our life through inward commitments and outward deeds. Our faith in God, even when we can't see things, our faith is the foundation for sustaining strength in our suffering. We don't stop seeking personal holiness when times are hard. Thirdly, be wary of letting your eyes direct your heart. Practice faith in what is unseen. And I'll invite our worship team up as I mentioned this last point. But what we reveal in our short suffering is beautiful. But what we reveal on our long suffering is priceless. And here's what I mean by that is there will be times where things are hard or you're full of anxiety or frustration or confusion and maybe even indeed suffering. But sometimes those moments are compressed and they don't last very long. And when we cling to God in times of short suffering, that is beautiful. But there are some people that God has chosen to endure seasons of long suffering, sometimes even a life of hardship or suffering. And when people cling to God over long suffering, the testimony that they have is priceless.
We're so glad you found this message today. You can find more resources, including previous podcasts, at northstarfamily.org. Thanks again for listening, and we hope to see you next time at North Star Church.